This
Sorry.
conference will now be recorded.
Great, thanks for the reminder. Just doing brief introductions. Again, we do record these. We are treating them like public meetings, although there's some question in my mind whether technically they are actual public meetings or not. But we're treating them that way. The recording is a permanent record, as well as a brief meeting summary of that's basically the agenda and the topics discussed and who was in attendance as part of the permanent record of these meetings as well. But with that, I'm going to just go down the list and call on folks to do the potential conflict of interest statement. And I'll start with Lee. You're at the top of my list.
All right, Lee Blue. I have a potential conflict of interest because I work for Hayden Homes.
Great. And you guys build homes in Springfield. So
yeah, we're a residential developer within Springfield.
Okay. Next on my list, Lori, if you're able to pop on. I know you're...
Oh, I can. Great. I don't have any conflicts or potential conflicts.
Thank you. And Tim Hilton.
I own property in Springfield.
So that creates a potential conflict for you due to that?
Potential. Yes.
Thank you. Greg James.
Yes, Greg James. I own property in Springfield, and therefore I do have a potential conflict of interest.
Great. Thank you. Kristen Carley.
Kristen Carley. I'm the real estate development director for St. Vincent de Paul, and we do own and develop property in Springfield and therefore have a potential conflict of interest.
Great. Thank you. And Chris McAllister.
Chris McAllister, community member, no known conflict of interest.
Great, thanks, Chris. Jim McLaughlin. Are you on the line, Jim? Can you hear us? If we can't hear you yet, if you are. We may not have Jim fully yet, I'm not sure. I'll go on then to Betsy.
Hi, Betsy Schultz, representing the Springfield Board of Realtors, and I live outside of the city limits, so don't have any personal potential conflict of interest.
Great. Thanks, Betsy. So, Jim, if you are having technical difficulties, maybe you can jump off and try jumping back on, or maybe you're distracted, I'm not sure, but let us know if you're able to plug back in. So with that, I'm going to do just a really quick recap. There are no public here today. We worked through pretty much the majority of the siting standards last week, and I feel like I got good feedback on that. That included kind of lot size, building height, lot coverage is what we kind of ended on. I had mentioned at the end of last meeting, we might need to revisit lot coverage. I think based on the feedback I got, unless others feel like they want to say more about lot coverage, I think I'm pretty good on that at this point. Generally, I feel like, the direction is leaning towards more flexibility, and just recapping some of the notes from last week is that really trying to provide the most flexibility with the standards that we can. We'll see how that plays out into moving into the design standards that we talked about today. I think I've mentioned parking a number of times, and parking is technically considered under the siting standards. And so I think I'm gonna jump to that first before we dive into what actual design standards. And I'm gonna share the kind of the spectrum document that I had shared previously. If I can get to it here. This document, so it kind of, this is the more detailed version than what was in the original 15-page memo. And so parking is down here towards the bottom, but I do just want to touch on that now. And so the administrative rules adopted by the state set a maximum number of parking spaces for the middle housing types that we can allow. we had the city more broadly in our TSP, our transportation system plan implementation project that ended, I think, over a year ago now, implemented, updated a lot of the transportation related types of codes, including parking. These administrative rule standards, I would say, are pretty well in line with what those are, the newly adopted parking standards. I didn't do a side-by-side comparison on paper for us to look at today, but those standards that were recently adopted about a year ago by the City Council include being able to count on-street parking credits, and in certain situations, if it's available, and we define what available is, if it's not planned to go away, and if depending on how much frontage in front of each lot and those kinds of things. So that's kind of in place and set up already. So really my question for the committee today around parking is, should we use the Oregon administrative rule standards set up for the different housing types? And also allow on-street parking credit as we've already established, which puts us kind of into this middle column of this table, or should we have something less? So these number of spaces, 3 spaces for a triplex, 4 for a fourplex, and 1 space per unit for townhomes and cottage clusters are the administrative rule standards. And I'll just say hi, Anne, welcome. Thanks for joining us. And if I could put you on the spot really quick to just do your potential conflict of interest statement for the record, please.
Sure, yes, my name's Anne Delaney, and I don't believe I have a conflict of interest.
Great, thanks. And I'll just check in with Jim. Jim, were you able to hear us at all or join in? If you are, we can't hear you. I'm not sure you're able to reconnect, but anyway. So, Anne, we're just jumping right into kind of where we left off. I'm talking about the parking standards. Getting ready to turn it back over to the committee for your thoughts on where you think we should land with these parking standards. And I think with that, I'll just end it there and see if there's questions or anybody's thoughts and comments. So go ahead, Greg.
Well, I think I feel comfortable with the using the OARs, although moving toward the middle and allowing those on-street parkings to, on-street parking to offset some of those requirements. I think that's, I mean, you have to deal with a parking issue. And I think that puts us in the middle, but it does allow on-street parking as a credit toward on-site parking. And I think that's going to be palatable for the community as you move to the broader audience and try to sell these new standards. I think that's going to be palatable. So.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to chime in on parking?
This is Kristen. I definitely think that you need to have more flexibility than what the OARs set out. I'm not familiar with using on-street parking as a credit, and I hope it works. So I would, yeah, I guess just generally more flexibility, especially in areas that are downtown and close to transit corridors.
Yeah, and that's a great comment, and something we had put into the draft previously. I think I'd have to go back and look, but we did build in some provisions in the draft we released a year ago, prior to all the rules being in place, that contemplated certain middle housing types being allowed maybe in a higher density fashion if they were within, say, like a quarter mile of a established transit route and those types of things. So that's another kind of flexibility standard that we could propose, we could build back in to this, as an idea. And so building on that comment, Kristen, I think that's a good another way that you could potentially build in more flexibility if people have thoughts on that.
Mark, I want to go along with Kristen.
Okay. Thinking more flexibility is better, and especially in maybe along corridors or.
Where exactly? I think I brought up the corridor thing in the last session, actually. So yeah, I totally agree with that. And okay. There has to be some, as you say, some measure of how able a street is can, you know, be used for parking. But as long as that's there, I think there needs to be that kind of permissiveness, especially for middle housing.
Yeah. And just, you know, kind of off the top of my head a little bit, but as a quick recap of what the availability of on-street parking includes is if there's existing on-street parking and it's not planned in the TSP or in a capital improvement project to be removed, then they can count it. If for some reason there's on-street parking today that people use, but the city has a CIP project in the TSP that's planned to come in and remove it, say widen it to more lanes or add bike lanes and things like this, then they wouldn't be able to count it. It does have to be, I think the number is 18 feet, but I'd have to double check that, of curb frontage to be considered an on-street parking space, that kind of thing. And I want to say also one of the provisions is that it is improved street. If it's, I'm not sure exactly, but if it's not a city standard street, then it may or may not be able to be counted. So some of those types of things, again, those standards are set already in the code. We could potentially have a different set of standards for middle housing, but that would make things a little more complicated. Anyway, we could take a look at that though through the, you know, the public hearing process. So, others' thoughts?
I'd like to support what Kristen said, that we need flexible, as much flexibility as we can have for the standards. I do think it is a big neighborhood issue if you don't have enough. If your new development actually causes an issue with parking, but I think everybody should be able to use their front street frontage for parking count. I think I've always thought that was a little unreasonable that you couldn't. And then, of course, I agree with Tim and Kristen on the along corridors, transit corridors. You might really look at something like 0.5 spaces required per unit or something like that.
So reduce the standard altogether if you're along, say, a corridor or something, rather than just allowing on-street parking?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's something new I'm hearing, is even potentially reducing the standard if you're, say, within a, I'll just use that example, within a quarter mile of a established transit corridor or something. I don't know how downtown would work. We already have a exemption in the downtown area defined the boundary of where parking is exempt in the downtown area. So if people are going to do middle housing in that parking exempt downtown area, if Phil Farrington were on, I'd point out hit one of his the Chamber's properties example is right across from City Hall, and they've contemplated doing some housing. And you know, they don't have to provide parking, but just from a market standpoint, they want to do parking. But that's at their discretion how much they do. So anyway, I don't know if there would be a bigger area, you know, kind of closer in to downtown that might have a reduced parking standard.
Mark, I guess I was thinking about the transit line between Peace Health and downtown, that there might be some parcels out there. Might actually rely on the transit for a lot of their transportation or the majority of it. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of along those kinds of transit lines, the rapid transit, I guess.
Okay.
So
one thing we've looked at is, you know, transit lines can change over time, and that's kind of out of our control. So if we establish that provision and reference transit lines that may change, then it's a changing provision as well. And so that may be good or bad. I don't know, but it's one of the things we've talked about that is, it is what it is. So. Any other thoughts on parking? I think it sounds like we have, at least the people that have spoke generally agree with kind of that flexibility direction, which sounds fine.
I agree with that too, just as in case you're taking a quasi poll.
Okay, great, Lori, thanks. Yeah, and we're not doing votes and I'm just kind of, you know, I'm going to be reporting ultimately to the Planning Commission and the City Council and kind of reporting a summary of what I think I heard from this group. And I would encourage any members of this group to attend those, and I'm sure there will be some interest. And as we present this to the public too, representing what I generally heard from this group as kind of forming staff's recommendation, that I just didn't pull it out of thin air. I based it on some input from others, that kind of idea. What I'm not hearing is kind of this far right column of not having any requirement. And just letting the market purely decide, having zero requirement and just letting people build it if they want. Greg James mentioned also understanding the kind of delicate nature that the public in general is going to have of this issue. And if we propose no parking's required, there's going to be a lot more probably upset people than if we try and find a little bit more of a happy medium. So I think that makes sense from that standpoint.
Mark?
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I used to live off of Third Place, and anytime something would happen downtown, we would have everybody parking on our street. So I like the idea of having an incentive of maybe the city gives a credit somewhere for city controlled parking or whatnot, where they do have the lots that we pay for or whatnot, as a condition to help open up the parking options. But I know that this is not necessarily tied to this committee, but parking is an issue all over Springfield. And we often didn't have time, places to be able to park in front of our house. I had to walk 6 blocks one time to park when we had one of the downtown Liberty of Light festivals.
So. That's a really valid comment. I know one of the pieces of the discussion at the state level that we talked about quite a bit is, you know, when you allow somebody to count their on-street parking in front of their house, they kind of feel like then they own that space, which that's really not the dynamic. So there becomes almost this, you know, if somebody parks in my space in front of my house, then, you know, I have to park down the block, then that, you know, can create issues. And so that it's not that that is then your parking space. And I know the same thing goes, like, I think the Matt Knight Arena in Eugene around the University District is a good example. And there's lots of conversation about anytime there's a basketball game, the parking goes up into all the surrounding neighborhoods and everything. And so you're right, Chris, there's real impacts from how parking is managed, and especially, like you said, near downtown or other types of event facilities and things like that. So something to definitely keep in mind and be aware of. And I know the city more generally outside of this process is still, you know, working on or contemplating some more, you know, whether there's been discussion over the years about a city-owned structured parking garage and things like that. So I'm not sure how that will ultimately resolve, but it is a topic that's, continually discussed, I'd say. All right, well, I'm going to jump out of parking and get into the actual design standards. This table doesn't really do the design standards justice, but I want to just point out that really we're going to be talking about the triplexes and fourplexes, the townhomes and the cottage clusters. But I would say a really quick question, or hopefully a quick question, but one initial question for the committee is in response to duplexes. So the way our code is structured currently for duplexes is pretty wonky. It talks about whether or not they're in the low density residential district versus the medium or high density districts and have different standards. At this point, it's going to be more blanket, like one size fits all. But what the state rules say about duplexes is you can only apply standards to duplexes that apply to single family homes. So we don't regulate any design for single family homes. And my recommendation would be that we don't start to. But I just want to run it by this committee and see if there's potential disagreement with that, or generally agreement with not having any design standards for duplexes, because that would mean we have to start regulating design of single family homes. So thoughts on that question?
I agree with that. I don't think you should regulate it.
Seeing thumbs up. I don't think we want to get in the business of counting windows or doors or anything on every single family home we do. We're talking about a workload problem, but we already struggle to get all our single family home building permits. So I'm not hearing any opposition to that, seeing some good thumbs up. So I think we'll just bounce right off that one. So now moving into what we'll call the higher middle housing types, the plexes, townhomes, cottage clusters. The way the state structured them is it's kind of like as you go up from fourplexes to townhomes and then the cottage cluster, there's kind of more design standards built into those different provisions, generally kind of illustrated by these cells of this table. But what I want to do is jump to the actual model code itself that the state produced. And so this, starting with the section of triplexes and fourplexes, they use the term quadplexes. I don't particularly personally like that term as well as fourplexes. I don't have, you know, best interest in term. So when I say fourplexes, it's the same as quadplexes that the state uses more of. So I pointed you also in the email last week to the section of code that I have drafted, and it's this section 4.7300 is where I've essentially copy and pasted the design standards for the different higher middle housing types out of the state model code into our format for the different housing types. So at this point, the way this code is in draft form includes all of the allowed design standards for the higher middle housing types that are allowed in the state model code. So really my interest getting feedback from the committee is, should we ratchet down and away from those design standards, or should we start with keeping them as it's basically the most we can be allowed to regulate, the most design standards we can require on these different middle housing types. So as an example, and if you had a chance to look through these, you'll kind of get what a lot of them are. I'm going to scroll down here. This is the start in the model code, again, from the state of the design standards section. The first one really talks about entry orientation. There's some good diagrams of what they're trying to illustrate, talking about. I'm going to just run through these all really quick for the plexus category. And then this window standard, you know, 15% of the front facade would include windows and doors, and this is kind of illustrated there. You know, and at the committee level at the state, these were really seen as kind of a bare minimum of, you know, trying to build in some kind of neighborhood compatibility, because, you know, recognizing that middle housing types are a little bit, I guess, more intrusive than just a single family home. So now that these middle housing types are essentially going to be allowed in almost every single family home neighborhood, this is the attempt to kind of deal with that. So garages and off-street parking areas, these provisions are creating some real concern for our transportation engineering staff. The one big concern is not anticipating distance from a corner. So this diagram, as an example, doesn't illustrate a corner lot. And so we have clear vision areas at corners and also minimum distances for a driveway from a corner. So say on this side, the left side of this diagram, if this were another street over here, this driveway under our other city standards wouldn't be allowed because it'd be way too close to the intersection. But I'm not sure the way, I'm having our city attorney look at some of that and see if we can even, you know, implement those other safety standards, or if we're kind of bound by these. But the driveway and access are also these other, the maximum widths and things are really what's dealt with. So that's kind of the top three for the plexes, I would say. So entry orientation, the amount of windows and doors, and then the garage and driveway provision. So I'm going to stop there, maybe kind of do this by housing type duplexes, and then we'll move on to townhomes and cottage clusters. But if people want to provide comments more generally about all of it too, feel free. But I'm going to stop there and turn it back over and hear what people have to say about these three provisions, specifically for the plexes.
The Mark, the only thing that I'd be concerned with would be, regardless of which plex it is, was you maintain your vision triangle to your intersections. And I think they should be held to the same as single family resident standards on all the corners, just from a safety standpoint.
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I think it would be reasonable to get there. If it's a provision that we apply across the board to all housing types, it's really the test under the statute is really this unreasonableness. And are we unreasonably putting some standard on middle housing types that we're not putting on other housing types? And these design standards definitely are. We don't have any design standards for single family homes. So we are putting some additional ones potentially. The state's allowing us to put some additional ones on middle housing types. But if there's provisions that apply across the board, I think we're pretty safe, especially based on kind of safety. But again, I need verification from our city attorney how we want to read that. And we'll probably try and get some feedback from the state as well. So that's a good comment, Lee. Thanks for that. Others' thoughts? Yeah, Greg.
Well, Mark, I think that it's going to take, we've got some expert folks here in this group, and you have a planning commission and city council and a lot of other people that are going to look at this. But I know the group that formed the state standards were intellectual planners and folks that have dealt with this type of issue for years and years and years. And I think it would be presumptuous of me to say, I think X or Y about these standards. I think we probably, from my standpoint, I think probably these standards specifically, we ought to adopt and live with for a while, unless there are some glaring issues that we see that are really restrictive in a way that we don't see as being usable and workable. And the thing is, we have to be less stringent than what these standards indicate. So the 15% window space, I mean, we can allow less window space than that, but I think that a lot of thought and back and forth conversation went into setting these kind of as a standard to work from. And I think it would be a little presumptuous for me personally to make recommendations. You know, you have others here that have a design background or some experience that may be able to make some, but my general feeling is these standards specifically, we ought to, see about the setback from a corner and some of the issues that you talked about for safety and those types of things. But, the standards is generally, I think we probably need to live with for a while and let the planners and the folks that are evaluating projects that are coming in and the contractors who are applying these standards to what they're trying to build, I think it's gonna have to, go through an iterative process to really be refined and really do what it's supposed to do and allow the flexibility that needs to be allowed. That's my two cents.
Great, thanks. It sparked a couple of things. And Tim, let me just get to you in a second. One thing I'll mention, we did talk a bit last time about, in all the siding standards, the recommendation generally in my mind is very loose, we're very permissive. But there was some concern expressed last time about impacts, you know, privacy in backyards and things. So as an example, and Greg kind of some of his points brought this up in my mind is, for instance, we can't regulate windows or anything on side facades or side elevation. I think Greg's point about we could allow a less than 15% window and door standard, but we couldn't require 20%. So you're right in saying we can have a lesser standard, but we can't have a more restrictive standard. And we also can't come up with new standards to say, oh, let's regulate the side or anything else. The other thing, lastly, I'll mention is that kind of comes up along the line of thought that you were mentioning, Greg, is there's Measure 56 repercussions, which some of you will recall. Measure 56 requires the city to send notice to surrounding to all property owners if we're going to change the zoning of the property that might reduce the value of the property. So it's generally is applicable pretty broadly. And so, and my example is, so say we started without a standard, or say we said, no, we should lower the 15% window standard to 5%. And then we realized that was bad and wanted to go back to 15. That would be putting more onerous standards on those developments that has a Measure 56 implication for the city, where a property owner could say they didn't have to meet it because that wasn't in place when they bought it. Anyway, I'm talking about this at a really high level. There's a lot more nuance to it. But so starting from the spot here, one, you know, the state says we have to kind of allow these middle housing types, and here's the standard. If we wanted to back down from it later, it doesn't create the same Measure 56 implication. It's easier to lower it than to raise it, is my general point. So anyway, with that, Tim, go ahead.
Well, I liked a lot of what Greg was just saying. And as far as the window percentage, you know, we're talking about high density housing here. We're not talking about low density housing. So it seems that yes.
And if I can just, so this was a point also just I did at the state committee level that was very hammered home a lot, is that this is not high density housing. I mean, it depends on how you define it. This is purely just for middle housing, which is really, and it's going into single family home type low density neighborhoods, but it's not apartment complexes or, you know, high rises. It is truly, we're talking about it in the confines of middle housing, which in the grand scheme of density ranges isn't at the upper end of the density ranges. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Well, in some cases, I can see that being applied to higher density. So, whenever there's a minimum of resources to a property, then there needs to be some kind of boundaries that are set up to protect those resources, including daylight. And that was my concern about the percentage of windows. It seems like we're talking about tighter lots, smaller lots here. And so that would be, it seems that there's a reasonable request to protect the amount of daylight coming in from the front of the building. And that seems really reasonable to me. All the other issues seem reasonable to me too, as far as parking and garage doors and front door orientation. At first I was going to say, that my only problem was that there was a kind of a dearth of models that we were only looking at like straight on rows, but further down there are some corner models, and you know, it seems like a reasonable attempt to deal with the issues that you were bringing up as far as clearance at the corners.
Yeah, I didn't know if there were specific to the driveway locations, maybe for the townhomes, like right here, you're mentioning the collector. Here's a
Yeah, there's one, but go a little even further down. There's more. Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
here you go. And this is, this is driveway approach options. Yeah, you're right. So some of them do contemplate it. Yeah, good for pointing that out. Thank you.
As long as there's enough models, and then it seems that you're covering your bases.
Yeah, and just to be clear too, this is the state model code. They've made these, you know, figures that they developed available open source for all the jurisdictions to use. I'm not anticipating creating new figures or diagrams for our specific code, but that may be something we get directed to do later at some point if the council wants to find some budget for that to happen. I do just want to point out very quickly, the section of code I had sent out to you, the 4.7300 section that does include all of these, way further down in this section of code, down below all the middle housing stuff, there is a section, just because we kind of brought up this higher density stuff, and I'm just probably making y'all motion sickness by scrolling. So this is the section here. That's not it. Where'd it go? So this architectural standard section applies to multiple unit housing, which is really has more to do with the kind of the higher density housing. So this would be like apartment complexes. And then, so this is the multi-unit housing beyond the middle housing. This is what we would see typically more in development in the medium and high density, or R2 and R3 districts, where there's, you know, more like apartment complexes. So there's a whole nother section of code that deals with some of those design standards related to those types outside of the middle housing stuff that we're talking about now. I just wanted to clarify that. Anyway, anybody else?
Mark, I have a question, and it kind of has to do with all the diagrams have one unit, one entry. And when I read through things, I didn't find anything that said every unit, that two units couldn't share like a entry porch or something like that. And I just wondered, is that allowed in middle housing, or is it really every unit or dwelling has its own private entry?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely allowed. I think the way it's contemplated, it would allow a shared entry. And I know some traditional or historic kind of duplexes I lived in one in Bend, actually. It was like a fiveplex, but it was a big old house that had one front door, and you go in and the interior doors each unit are off of an interior. But somewhere in here, and I get back up to the entry, really this door, it says at least one main entrance for each triplex or fourplex. So to me, that first sentence is what's talking about, you have to at least, only one main entrance has to meet this standard. And if all you have is one main entrance for the triplex or fourplex, then that one main entrance would have to meet this standard.
Okay.
But it could be shared.
Okay. All of the diagrams seem to suggest that each unit has its own entry. And so I didn't want that to be a requirement, because I think shared entries actually are quite useful sometimes.
Yeah, and I agree. And, you know, these diagrams are just meant to be examples and to try and generally illustrate some of the provisions, but definitely not try and cover all the examples. So okay. In my mind, even just like this example, you're right, it shows one unit, but this is just easily could be the two or three units. The other thing is this could be the front unit and you might have two more behind it where their main entrances face the side or something, like the sidewalk goes back. And so those additional units, their entrances could face the side or somewhere else and not have to orient to the front.
But if I were stacking my dwelling units, if you look at this example that you have up, and I was going to do an internal stair, so I could have a foyer, a door to the ground floor unit, and then a stair that goes up to the upper units.
Yeah.
That's allowed. Okay.
Yeah. The other thing I'll just mention quickly too is that these design standards do not apply to a conversion of a single family home into one of these middle housing types.
Right.
Which is kind of an interesting loophole. I mean, I've thought about technically if somebody couldn't or didn't want to meet these standards, they could build a single family home and then convert it to the duplex or triplex, say that they wanted to get around some of these standards, which I think would be kind of probably more trouble than it's worth. But anyway, that's the way it's written, is that these stand. So you might have, you know, a single family home that doesn't have a front door that orients to the street at all, but, you know, and they convert it to a duplex. So anyway, just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
I'll just mention Christina joined us. Thanks for being here, Christina. Others thoughts on kind of the triplex, fourplex, these three or four design standards? It sounds generally like people are okay with keeping these, the standards that the rules allow us to have in place. Seeing some thumbs up. Okay, any thoughts? And so that
Looking at the cottage cluster section, page 31 of 33 on the model code, speaking about parking related to cottage clusters, and it says 16 cottages or more permitted parking clusters of not more than 8 contiguous spaces. So cottage clusters, I think they were on your other spectrum as far as number of spaces, weren't they? What I'm reading there is only half of the one parking space, or 0.5 for each cottage. Is that what that's kind of pointing to, Mark, or am I not reading that correctly?
I think to me what that sentence is saying, and it's 6A2, and I scroll through here on the screen, is that's not the parking standard. So the standard is still one space per cottage.
Okay.
I think what this is saying is let's use the 16 cottage example. You couldn't put all 16 spaces together in one parking cluster. You'd have to have two different parking clusters with 8 spaces each to kind of break up the mass of parking. That's what that's telling me. That's how I read that.
Got it. And then, And then this parking location and access may be in relation to some on-street parking.
Yeah. And they do reference a figure here, figure 27. Is that this one? Let's see here really quick. That's 26. Here's figure 27. So, I mean, you can see how they've broken up these parking clusters with a landscape strip between them. So I think that's kind of what they're talking about, at least in that first big question. This shows some on-street parking here out in the street.
Got it. Okay, not to belabor the point, I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. So we kind of jumped over townhomes a little bit, and we can just go back to that really quick. So I think we covered the triplex and fourplex, and it may be a common theme. I think cottage cluster, where there actually might be potentially some of the most conversation. So if townhomes are pretty similar to from the committee standpoint, if your thoughts are pretty similar to the flexes, in that we should just kind of keep the minimum design standards allowed under rule, that's fine. Or we can pick and choose a little bit. Although, so they do include some more standards. So as soon as you go to townhomes, in addition to the standards we talked about for plexes, the one they add is, they call it unit definition, which I think to me is kind of a weird name for it, but really what they're talking, so there's still this entry orientation that's similar to the plexes. And here's this unit definition. I'm going to skip it just for a second. They also keep the same window percentage, 15%, and then the driveway and access parking, similar to the plexus, with showing some different configurations. So the new one is really more kind of design. And what it says is, so these are these design features, roof dormers, balconies, bay windows, offsets in the facade, recessed entries, covered entries, and porches. What it says, each townhouse house must include at least one of these. So picking one, so I think this is an example, in my mind, of four townhomes in a row here. So they've, I think, probably shown more than would be required, but each, like this unit has two, this unit has two, this unit arguably has one or two, this unit may only have one. So, but if each unit only has to have one of these, I mean, so you can imagine a builder is going to want to do whatever maybe is quickest and easiest, so they're just going to put a covered entry on each one of them, and they're all going to look identical or something. They may not, they may whatever, give each one a bay window, or they might switch it up and build some variety into it. But what, I guess, you know, what do people think? Do you think that this is a reasonable standard for us to keep for townhomes?
I think it's a pretty minimal standard. I think everybody would probably be able to meet it, so.
Thumbs up. It's interesting to me that, you know, you could build a fourplex and then, or build a four unit, a townhome, and on the ground it is essentially the same building. It's just that one has lot lines and one doesn't, so you can sell them separately. And one requires design standards and one doesn't. But anyway, for what it's worth, they're allowing these design standards for townhomes. You know, there's some really good townhome examples in Bend and certain parts of Bend where they've built long rows of them. And a lot of them do just kind of cookie cutter. They're also narrow. A lot of times they don't have a whole lot of facade to do much with. But, you know, anyway, for what it's worth, I think it adds some variety to your potential interest and not just flat fronts. So I saw a number of thumbs up. Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
That I agree completely with the comments of Anne and the sentiment of most of the people with a thumbs up. That, but that diagram, figure 22, for me, is a mess. And and I'm in a free country, somebody could build that if they want to, and I would hate to be the one to say yes because they saw it on figure 22 of the code. The best townhouses are simple. The best townhouses are rows, are walls of windows with doors punctuating in regular rhythm, you know. That those are the best townhouses, especially when we're talking about cookie cutters. At least you get something out of it. And something like this is just such a nightmare. To me, it suggests the wrong thing to do rather than the right thing to do.
I think the diagram is really just trying to illustrate the options.
I understand, but Mark himself, his first comments were along the lines of that this might be a real you know, option. And so I totally agree. I would just wish there was a better way to show these options, not suggesting that a single building have them all.
Yeah. Agreed.
I think what you're hearing, Mark, is don't include this illustration in our, you know, you can list the roof, those descriptions are all a designer needs to be able to figure out what they are. Don't include this hot mess in the actual, our actual code.
I thought Tim might be volunteering to draw up a better diagram.
I'm too old and overpaid to do a diagram like that.
Yeah, right, me too. No, so you know, that's a good point. So maybe, you know, I've heard a lot of comments that the diagrams are good and, you know, it illustrates things and gives. But you're right. I mean, there might be a better way to illustrate this rather than this kind of not great diagram. So I'll take that to consideration, and maybe we'll hear that from others. You know, there might be the potential that somebody could draw up something to illustrate it in a better way.
There are better examples, I believe, in this document, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they just might not show those design options. I mean, specifically down in Cottage Cluster. No, I don't see any down there, but.
There was one that had an elevation of I think it was a cottage cluster of like three residences.
It might have been the draft code section that I had scrolled down to earlier for multifamily stuff.
I have so many documents up on my desktop right now.
Something like one of these. Is this?
It was nicer than that.
This one?
Yeah, ding.
So maybe we use a document or an example like this instead of that other one. I mean, it doesn't include porch columns and eaves, but anyway, that's something to consider. That might be a better diagram. So this is something that's in under the architectural detail styles for multiple unit housing. But we might be able to recycle it for townhomes. Okay. So I'm hearing generally people are okay again with the minimum standards allowed in the OARs for us to regulate. Great. And so let's jump into cottage cluster. There's a lot more standards in cottage clusters. And you know, cottage clusters in my mind are definitely a different style of development. It's pretty flexible. It's almost like a mini PUD in my mind. It could be, like we talked about, and I say PUD, planned unit development, kind of a concept for larger property. But we talked about the flexibility to allow cottages on individual lots or allowing multiple units on one lot, so that, you know, trying to build those types of flexibility options into it. So, but really when we get in to the design standards, there's some talk about community buildings. One of the concepts related to cottage housing that there's more common open space, there's a common courtyard. It kind of offsets the idea, instead of individual cottages having their own private yard, it's more of a shared common open space type of layout, as some of the diagrams illustrate. So there's regulations about connectivity with, you know, if you do have parking that's clustered, the connectivity for pedestrians to each cottage. I'm just kind of highlighting some of these. Here are some of the list of the standards if you've had a chance to look about it. 50% of the cottages oriented to common courtyard. You know, I went back and kind of did some comparison to the previous version of cottage clusters that we had reviewed a year ago that was based on the city of Milwaukee's. And it's pretty close. It's pretty similar stuff. I can't remember off the top of my head the one example that, you know, there was something that we wouldn't be allowed to do now. And I think it had to do with maybe either height or setbacks and things like that. But most of the design stuff was pretty similar. So I don't necessarily feel like I need to go through these one by one, but maybe they can just chat about if something jumps out at them, or we can highlight one and talk in more depth about like, why is that in there? Those kind of things. They do talk about porches, detached versus attached buildings, some of those types of things. So I'll turn it back to the committee to see if people have thoughts, and then I could dive into more if we need to. It's definitely one, it's a little trickier to get your head around a little bit because it's such a different housing type that we're used to, but. Anybody willing to take a stab at providing comments, or should we just go with it?
This is Kristen. I would just say that, like you referred to, the city of Milwaukee, I think, has some of the best ones. And if it's close to that, then I think it's great.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think if anything, it may be in one or two spots, it's dialed back a little bit, not having quite as rigorous standards, this model code from what the city of Milwaukee's was. It's definitely not more kind of restrictive. So it's less errors.
I did find it's under item number 7 on page 28 that it talks about off-street parking. Yeah. And it says 0 spaces per unit for cottages less than 1,000 square feet and one per unit for floor area over 1,000 square yeah. feet. And then below it talks about on-street credit also. So I think that's very appropriate. So.
Well, that is so in general, kind of what the model code lays out from the state versus the minimum requirements from the administrative rules. The model code is kind of more permissive. And so this is an example where the most we can require is one space per unit, but we can always require less. So this is an example of requiring less in certain cases, like it's encouraging smaller units, which in theory, in some people's minds equates to more affordable units, but it also then creates, it's more affordable because they're having to develop less parking. So, and actually now that you point this out, I'm curious if this translated into the, I don't think I put that in our part in our section. I think I was leaving it as one space per unit just across the board. So that's a good example of where we could build in more flexibility. It did two things. It allowed the on-street parking credit as well as a reduced standard for smaller cottage units. So Greg, I hear you saying you like that, you would support something like that.
I do. I like the flexibility, although this is a 22-foot space, minimum space for street credit. And you indicated that you thought our current code was 18. So I would double check that.
I'm going to put Christina on the spot, and if she might have a second to dive into our existing code. Christina, when we did the TSP implementation, we put in the on-street parking standard credit. Do you remember the front end was, I thought off the top of my head, it might've been 18. Is that something you could check for me in a minute? And you could circle back. So we'll check that. And so here's where I included it in the draft code. It's on page 20 or 49 of that 4.7.300 section. And this is under the cottage cluster section. So I didn't build in that flexibility of, you know, 0 spaces for units under 1,000 or whatever. Did you find something, Christina?
Yeah, yeah. It's section 4.6.110G, and it's a for each 18 feet of available on-street parking, there's a half space credit. So that's kind of reflecting that at any one time, on-street parking is open to anyone. We don't reserve it for.
And there was some other language in there about it had to be in terms of it being available, it
yes.
wasn't planned to be removed and those types of things.
Right, no adopted plans to remove it. So in some places, notably like on Fifth Street as you're coming towards City Hall, there is on-street parking there, but there is an adopted TSP project to put bike lanes in that would take up at least one side of the street's on-street parking, and so that like a property there can't count that as on-street parking for the future because it's not planned to continue to be there in the current planning horizon.
So, you know, what do people think? I mean, in terms of building in this more type specific to cottage clusters, even a little bit more parking flexibility, it might be a housing type that might be more conducive to that. I'd have to again, my recommendation would be trying not to make it in terms of the on-street parking credit, not necessarily to confuse it and create a different on-street parking credit for cottage housing, different from our existing one. But one, we could reduce the space for a certain size, and in addition, have the on-street parking credit, which we already talked about including. But go ahead, Tim.
I think, once again, the discussion earlier about relationship to fixed transit lines would come into play here too. If you're talking, we can make too broad of an assumption, I think, about the scale and who is living here. And it makes, I think the market would sort it out in a way that it would make it more desirable to have these kinds of clusters close to transit lines. So if that's the way it worked, then yes, I would say you have it covered. If these weren't in areas covered by transit, I don't know. You still have the need for parking.
And Christina, again, I was talking earlier, I think before you jumped on, but about I don't think we included with the TSP implementation the proximity to transit for any kind of parking credit. Do you see anything in there as you're looking at it for that? Or do you recall?
We did do the, I'll look for it real quick. Frequent transit corridor. So it's a reduction based on frequent transit corridors. I don't know that this applies to residential because of the way that we structured residential parking. But it might, I can check that. That'll save me a bit. But we did provide 15% credit of off-street motor vehicle parking. I guess it doesn't explicitly exempt residential. So would apply to residential 15% reduction if you are abutting a frequent transit corridor on the Springfield Transportation System plan, and a 10% reduction when you are within a fourth mile from a frequent transit corridor. That's going to make more of a difference, obviously, when you have like a cottage cluster or townhome where the minimum required parking is on the order of 10 spots or more, because a 15% reduction in three spots is still three spots.
Yeah.
We'll round up to the next spot.
Yeah, you basically have to have at least 10 spots to have any of that credit count, unless it's cumulative. I think there was a credit for providing extra bicycle parking too. So if I think a cottage cluster development provided like a community covered or protected bicycle parking facility, that there's an additional, and these are additive credits if I recall, right?
Yeah, additive credits with I think an upper max of
25%
is my memory. I'm not seeing it right here in the code language.
So, but it's definitely something so we could look and see how it works in conjunction with our existing credits. But also, I think, broadly for middle housing, we could have some kind of exemption or credit, but and then specific to cottage cluster without trying to make it too complicated. Whether it sounds like, Tim, you were saying maybe not let the market control it based on these others and not have a zero spaces based on size of cottage units.
I think there are different markets. And so if that means let the market control it, then I guess that's what I'm saying. But what I mean is that places from further away from transit would be a different rental market, than places closer to transit. And if these are rentals. And it just seems that there should be a way to accommodate both of those without being so general as to obliterate the difference.
Okay. Greg, were you raising your hand?
Yeah, just one more point. I cottage clusters to me, Mark, and we talked early on about these being able to be platted so that they could be owned individually. And I think this has a potential as a cornerstone for affordable housing. And I think we need to bear that in mind. I think the credits that you're talking about for a covered bicycle shelter and being close to transit. And, you know, we need to make it doable so that we have Lee here today. But, you know, one of the disadvantages of this type of a complex is the cost of getting the power and the water into those individual units and being able to meter them separately. So I think whatever we can do from this standpoint to give the builder flexibility and leverage the ability to either park on the street or have some credit for having bicycle parking or those types of things, I think we ought to be as flexible as we can for the builder to be able to leverage those things.
I'm just going to jump in. I completely agree with Greg, because I see this as an affordable home ownership opportunity, and we need to make sure we address these issues. So it really is that.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things, so, and I didn't provide you guys copies of these, but there were some market feasibility analysis reports done by Eco Northwest for the state committee for, you know, trying to assess standards and, you know, reasonability, or what's the word? I'm blanking on the term, but, you know, whether they're unreasonable standards or not. And so one of the things these financial feasibility analysis by Eco for the state found was parking is one of the things that increases the cost of providing housing most. So the more parking that's required is, you know, just, and it's not only the cost of providing the parking itself, is the amount of space of the land that eats up to provide the parking also. So I think that resonates with what you guys are kind of saying. And Lee, I know you put your mic on, and I was actually going to put you on the spot a minute ago. And I think it was a Hayden project up in Washington, maybe, where they used one of the city's cottage cluster developments to create kind of a uniquer type of neighborhood. Do you recall anything like that? Or
I don't, out of my region, to be honest with you, I don't know. I just want to fall back and say that the more flexible you can be within reason with your builders on parking, on the building aesthetics from the corner, from the street frontage, the more flexible you can be within reason, the more likelihood your builder is going to actually entertain building that. And if you want to encourage more housing, then you need to be a little flexible, and not just from, I'll say, a Hayden point of view, but from my personal point of view. I come into this with 30 years of construction experience, residential, light commercial. 25 of that was before I came to work for Hayden. So I have walked away from a job more than one in years gone by, because the city had drew a line in the sand and it was their way or no way. So pretty soon it becomes financially not beneficial to the builder. So I think it's important to retain some flexibility and workability with whoever the builder might be in order to achieve your ultimate goal, which is affordable housing.
Yeah, and I agree with the sentiment I think I'm hearing too, and that is, out of all the middle housing types, I think cottage clusters are one that can provide people the most creativity to design something that works, especially when we're talking about kind of constrained sites. You know, any sites in Springfield and lots of cities that are left are kind of the difficult sites for one reason.
They're left for a reason.
Yeah. So it's either wetlands or oftentimes infrastructure, and we know that, and we're trying to work on that. But so I agree. I think, you know, especially with cottage housing, might be the best place to make the case where it's like almost, you know, clean slate here. You design it, what you think will work, and build it. And, you know, I referenced the conversation meeting I had with Dan Hill, who developed the cottages in Eugene off River Road. And I think he pretty much said if he had it to do over again, he wouldn't do it, you know. And utilities is definitely one of those things, especially water, that we as the city can't control. And I know utility services to each unit is a can be a deal killer. And, you know, again, I've said this before, but to repeat it, our city council's interested for sure through their housing strategy to encourage home ownership opportunities. And again, I think the cottage cluster is a opportunity to build somewhat affordable, you know, given our environment today with what affordable means, a market rate affordable option. So anyway, I'm hearing just more flexibility. I think, you know, Greg, you're pointing out this zero spaces per unit. And I think it's telling me to do a little more work with the cottage cluster and some of the standards and the parking standards and making sure the requirements are appropriately sized and also the credits are appropriately in place to work together to give, you know, developers the most options. Does that sound about right? Trying to sum up what I've heard, seeing head nods and thumbs up. So good. Yeah. Well, I feel like that pretty much covered what I wanted to cover. And I mean, we didn't get into kind of some of the more nuanced community buildings and pedestrian access and things. If anybody has thoughts about any of that stuff and want to talk about any of that, we have about 15 minutes left today. Or just more broadly, any general comments about the process, how we feel it's going. And we're going to move pretty quickly into the spring, and I'm going to be releasing code sections starting in May, going 3 months away, which for me is going to fly by. I got a lot of work to do. I'm trying to do both housing code and commercial industrial employment code stuff at the same time, and it's just there's going to be a lot starting to come out as we move into spring. So there will be definitely more opportunity for all of you as individuals or, you know, community members to provide input through the process, public hearings as we get there towards the end of the summer. But anything else people want to say or just broadly feedback from you is all, any of it's beneficial to me.
Mark, I did want to have a clarification. I was a little bit confused when Christina was reading the credits that you got for on-street parking.
Okay.
What I thought we were doing, I thought she says about a half of credit for each off-street or on-street parking. And I thought if you had four spaces required, you could put a certain, that you got a one-to-one credit. You didn't have a percent of a credit. Was I missing something there?
The current code allows on-street parking, each on-street parking space to count as half of a space of off-street parking. So if you wanted to eliminate, that's current code. That's just what exists right now.
Okay.
That's what we had come up with.
What we're doing through this middle, for this middle housing, is that it's a one-to-one. It's credit, right?
Yeah, well, we haven't really, I wouldn't say we specifically landed on that, but if that's the thinking, I mean, I'm happy to move that forward in terms of a recommendation that's specific to middle housing types. And maybe the broad standard needs to change, but even just specifically to middle housing, maybe it is. I think part of the thinking, and I was just trying to find it here. I don't know where those credits are, but this is bicycle parking. But is because there is this cumulative credit approach that if you get a half a credit for the on street in front, I mean, you need a pretty wide lot to get two on street parking spaces to get a one space credit under the existing code standards. So I think what I'm hearing is, at least for middle housing, we should propose a one-to-one credit instead of the 0.5-to-1 credit.
That would be my thought. I mean, if you can get two cars in front of your lot, and then you have two on the lot with the driveway and clearances and stuff, it seems like you should be able to say that you have four parking spaces. So,
yeah, how do you park half a car?
What does that mean?
Where's the other half the car park if you can only park half of it in the street?
Yeah, no, I know. And that does, you know, we round up, right? So if you're required to have 1.5 spaces, that means you have to provide two. So it's really not doing anything at that point, essentially, unless you're also within a quarter mile of a transit corridor and get that 10% reduction, then it gets you to 1.4, which I can't remember if we round down after one, after the halfway point, or if it's a 0.4, they have to also require the full space.
No, I think that it's around, it's always around up to the next whole number is my, that's my recollection. I think we, there may be code language that I could look at, but you know, if you've calculated it's 1.5 spaces and you get a half space credit for on-street parking, then it's one. So we don't round up the number and then apply credits to it. You take the, you calculate the minimum parking required, then you apply credits in either a half space or a percentage, and then you round to the number required. And again, these were, when we did the TSP code, we were really looking mostly at large developments, commercial industrial developments, and then large multifamily housing developments. And the middle housing wasn't the targeted idea. We did spend some time talking about single unit detached dwellings and how that would affect this, how that would play out, but middle housing wasn't part of that conversation. So that really wasn't something that was thought about.
And that's exactly right. It wasn't even really on our radar yet. So I think revisiting it at this point is completely appropriate. And I think it's something that we could propose. I've written down, you know, proposed 1-to-1 ratio for the on-street credit for middle housing types. And understanding, again, we're talking, somebody mentioned earlier, the what's going to be palatable to the community and people's fears around too much on-street parking or not enough on-site parking. And so really just trying to balance those concerns, and we'll just go with it and see where it goes through the process. But
I guess my feeling with the on-street parking is we've already got those streets built and it's already impervious area. We ought to park as much as we can there.
I kind of jokingly said, somebody, I mentioned structured parking. You know, the city's talked about it for years about trying, you know, what one of the city's biggest pieces of infrastructure they have are the streets that exist today. And if we're not utilizing all that pavement for, you know, what it's there for, then what are we doing with it? It's kind of one level surface, structured parking all over town. But anyway,
yeah. And it actually, in a residential neighborhood, more street parking you have, the slower people drive. Good traffic control.
All right, any other thoughts, comments? Okay,
Mark, I'd just like to say I've appreciated this process. I know you indicated that this may be the last time we meet for a while, and I have totally enjoyed getting to know each of the members of this committee. We all come with a different background and different experiences, and I appreciate every one of your visions for how this new code will support middle housing in Springfield. And you know, and I've learned personally, I've learned an enormous amount from each of you and your perspective. So thanks to each of you. I would just say to Mark, please keep this group in the communication loop as you move forward, even if we're not formally going to convene again before this goes to the Planning Commission. You know, just, you know, you don't have to update us. My feeling is, you know, iterations that you're doing on a weekly basis, do, you know, the kind of your tag before your final move toward the Planning Commission, at least to have us at kind of how the final your final draft codes turned out before you choose to move forward, and then connect us or notify us as to when those meetings are going to occur, so that if we choose to attend, we can do so.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think the easiest way for me to do that would be to have you, if you're not already, is to add you all to our interested parties list for this project. We do e-updates, and that's how we'll send out, well, one of the ways we'll send out the draft public review sections of the code. So you'll all get that in May when we release it. So I'll just take it upon myself to add you all to that. And you could probably email me to unsubscribe if you don't want to be on that list, or just send me an email telling me not to add you if you don't want to be. And then, yeah, I want to definitely express my appreciation for all of your involvement. It's been hugely helpful for me, especially in kind of this disjointed fashion that we had a year break and then I wrangled you all back in to relook at this. It was a little tough to get the whole committee. I think, you know, some folks weren't as available as they were a little over a year ago. And given the kind of interesting times that we're all living into to do this all virtually and everything, I really appreciate you guys taking the time and effort and putting the energy into it. It's definitely hugely beneficial to me and I think the process in general. So thank you all very much. I wish the city could do more for our great volunteers that commit a lot of their time. You know, I was in a meeting just the other day about, you know, we compare ourselves a lot to Eugene and we think we do some things better. You know, Eugene's actually paying members of the public right now to participate in some of their processes through a grant they got. And so we're not able to do that at this point. We'd love to even just provide you gift cards for coffee cards or something. But anyway, know you're appreciated. Know I thank you very much. And so I will keep you in the loop and potentially even call on you again as we move through this. So.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been really a pleasure to watch all this come together. And I've said multiple times in other groups across both Eugene and Springfield just how your leadership has been just so critical to this process and trying to keep the city as flexible as possible. So I'm excited to see what comes out of this and appreciate having been able to be involved.
Yeah, thanks, Betsy. I appreciate it. We will be doing outreach in the public, you know, going to whether it's the chamber, the Realtors Association, any groups we can find. Kind of beating the street to try and get the public to be involved more generally. So if anybody has thoughts about different outreach ideas, we're looking to be as creative as we can, given that we can't hold a big public open house. We will have a virtual online open house. But anyway, trying to get feedback once we do release it for the public input too. Well, great. I think with that, unless anybody has anything else, we can all get a few minutes back here before 5 and get on with our evenings. But thanks again, everybody. Look all forward right. to talking with you again soon.
See you.
All right.
Stay healthy.
Thank you.